All right. Lesson 33, the life of times of John Calvin. And I got to be honest with you, I was real tempted to just skip Calvin altogether. Just because I really don't like him very much. But that's my personal opinion. But I know that's like sacrilege living in this area of Michigan to not appreciate John Calvin. But we're going to talk about him because it'd be pretty incomplete of a class if we didn't talk about Calvin. So today what we're going to do is talk about some of his, about Calvin the man, and then next week we're going to talk about what he believed. Okay? So we went from no weeks to 2 weeks pretty quick on Calvin. The conference flyers for the Bible conference this year are in. I'll make some of these available later this morning on the table. This is for September 16th through 18th here at the church. King James Bible 400, celebrating four centuries of God's Word in English, 1611 to 2011, is what it's about. There's you'll see, you can look in here at the different studies. Should be a good time, so we'll make that available. All right, John Calvin, the life and times of John Calvin. Like I said, in this area of Michigan, it's Calvin is, you know, you've got Calvin College, you had Kuyper College, you have Hope College, you have, you know, Tulip Time in Holland. You know, this area was settled by, you know, Dutch Calvinists, basically, that immigrated here from Europe. And so there's a big base in this area of Michigan of a lot of heavily Calvinistic people. My wife grew up in Holland, and we went down to Holland last Sunday for Mother's Day gathering in the evening, and we're driving through there, and there's like a Reformed church on every corner. I don't know how they all stay open, because they're all basically teaching the same thing, so I have no idea how they all stay open. But anyway, I want to start by looking at some things about Calvin's life, and particularly Calvin's early life. John Calvin was born July 10, 1509. At Nyon, in Paterkey, is how I say it, about 60 miles northeast of Paris. His father was in comfortable circumstances, and Calvin was raised in aristocratic society and had the manner of that class. Calvin was born, of all these guys, you know, he was born with some privilege here, okay? His dad had money. He was some sort of a mid-rank aristocrat within the French society at the time. And so Calvin kind of grew up with those benefits, if you will, of childhood, growing up in that type of a system at this time in history. Okay, in boyhood, he is rumored to have been deeply religious and critical of any laxity in morals. At the age of 14, Calvin attended the University of Paris. Coincidentally, Calvin matriculated through the university at the same time as Francis Xavier and Ignatius Loyola. Okay. Two of the men who would lead the Catholic Counter-Reformation, which we will talk about in a future lesson. So Calvin is in the University of Paris at the same time that Ignatius Loyola is there. They're matriculating through the school at roughly the same time. For those of you, how many have heard of Loyola? Okay, Ignatius Loyola is the founder of the Jesuits movement, and is going to be a big part of the Catholic Counter-Reformation against the Reformers and the Lutherans. Okay, but we'll talk more about him later. But for now, he's in there at the same time as some of these guys who would later be his chief opponents. Okay, influenced heavily by Renaissance humanism of the age, Calvin left Paris at the age of 19 to study law. Writing in elegant Latin and acquiring a knowledge of Greek and Hebrew, he published his first book at 23, a commentary on Seneca. Okay, so by 19, he's publishing. You know, he's following his career. You should notice a trend here. Okay. Wycliffe, Huss, even Luther to some extent, they all are men of letters. They're educated, they are professors, they're involved in that academic lifestyle of most of these reformers are, okay, to some extent. Now, while the details of Calvin's conversion are fuzzy at best, it is clear that he came under the influence of an early Protestant group in Paris, where he became acquainted with some of the writings of Erasmus and Luther. All right. So I'm not too sure about the exact details of, you know, Calvin's so-called conversion, other than the fact that it was predetermined, of course. But anyway, I'm not sure about this. He does come into contact of some people who are, you know, reading the works of Luther and Erasmus. Now, Timothy Paul Jones, the author of Christian History Made Easy, reports that in 1534, Calvin helped a friend write a speech that was peppered with quotes from Luther and Erasmus that angered the French government. All right? Forced to flee, Calvin went back to Nyon, France, before moving on to Bessel, Switzerland. It was during this time period that Calvin became both a believer and a Protestant, according to Jones. Okay? So he gets himself in trouble at the university by writing some stuff and using Erasmus and Luther as sources and quoting from them that upsets some people within the French establishment. Now you gotta understand, is the majority of France thoroughly Catholic? Okay? Yes. So this is not gonna be looked, you know, too favorably upon him doing this, okay? And then while he's at Bessel in 1536, Calvin published the first edition of his highly influential Institutes of the Christian Religion. The work was the clearest, most logical, and most readable exposition of Protestant doctrine the Reformation age produced, and it gave its youthful author European fame overnight. Calvin labored on its elaboration nearly all his active life. If you compare the early editions of the Institutes with the latter editions of the Institutes that he publishes late in life, towards the end of his life, he adds a lot of information to them the latter editions than what is in the first editions. Okay? Now, the Institutes, I told you last Sunday in our class that one of the things about Luther was that Luther was not a systematizer of information. Okay? And that's one of the reasons why he was attracted to Melanchthon to help him with that sort of activity. But Calvin is viewed as the big systematizer of Protestant theology. Okay, the Calvin's Institutes are viewed by church historians and by, especially if you're Reformed, I mean, these are like, you know, next to the Bible in terms of significance, Calvin's Institutes. But they're significant because they are clear, they are logical, they're much more readable than a lot of the things that Luther puts out. And so he is going to be the theologian that's going to sort of establish a lot of what come to be known as commonly held doctrines of the Protestant Reformation. Okay? Now, as we go through these things, some of them, you're going to obviously, I would think, object to a few of them, quite a few of them, possibly even. But that's where Calvin is going to receive his initial fame, is from writing the Institutes of the Christian Religion. Okay? Now, that's just a quick overview of Calvin's early life. Did you get any questions about that before we move on to point two? Yeah?
Was he just really super smart that he's in college at 14, or did they go at that time?
Yes and yes. Oh. He is super smart, and they did go a lot earlier than they do now.
Oh, okay.
You know, generally speaking. Now if somebody goes at 14, there's some kind of, you know, intellectual prodigy or something like that. Okay, it doesn't happen very often. But so the answer to your question is yes on both counts. They went earlier at a younger age, but he was also very smart. Okay, intellectual type guy. But he's able to write in a fashion that is not so over everybody's head that nobody understands what the heck he's saying either. Okay? So, Calvin's Institutes. Lorette reports that Calvin's Institutes won their way not from their originality of the ideas, but because of their clarity, orderly arrangement, and comprehensiveness. In other words, Calvin is not saying essentially anything really fundamentally different from Luther or some of the other guys. But what makes his work distinct is its clarity, its organization, and its comprehensiveness, which sets him apart from Luther as a systematizer of these doctrines. They were the most inclusive and systematic presentation of the Christian faith as held by the Protestants, which had thus far appeared. They set forth the entire cosmic drama of creation, sin, and redemption under the sovereign will of God, as Calvin believed it was taught in the Scriptures. Okay? So that's why he's getting a lot of attention for writing this book. The initial work was a mere 6 chapters in length. So it wasn't that really that necessarily that long. For the next quarter of a century, though, Calvin worked away at it, adding extra chapters and refined, rearranging the material. By the time of its final edition in 1559, the work had 80 chapters and was divided into four books. Okay, so that's, you know, you start with six chapters and you end up at the end of your life with 80 chapters, and if you definitely expanded upon what you originally thought. Okay, now you know what? I just a word about that. That's not unusual. Okay, because when people start out in the ministry, they should know more after 20 years of study than they knew when they first started, right? And as you study and grow in your understanding of things, you refine things, you tweak things, you sometimes change your mind about something you may have said, you know, 10, 15 years ago or what have you. So that expansion of the material that's found in the Institutes is a reflection of, you know, of that. Whatever thing you want to say about Calvin, for good or for bad, he's definitely a student. And he definitely is working at refining what he believes to be the truth and communicating it in that book. The first book in the Institutes deals with God the Creator and God's sovereignty over creation. Now, next Sunday we'll talk a lot more about the details of some of the stuff that Calvin believes. Okay, but one of the fundamental doctrines is this whole idea of the sovereignty of God. That nothing happens in the world outside of the eternal decrees and sovereignty of God. Okay? Every sparrow that falls from the air, whatever it is, every single minute detail of everything that transpires in creation is part of this sovereign, pre-planned, you know, preordained will of God according to what Calvin teaches. And I'll show that to you in more detail next week. But the beginning of the book, this first chapter of the Institutes, is about this God's sovereignty over the creation. Book 2 concerns the human need for redemption and the manner in which this redemption is achieved by Christ the Mediator. The third book deals with the manner in which this redemption is appropriated by human beings. And the final book deals with church and its relation to society. Okay? So he systematizes his thinking and his thoughts around those fundamental six initial ideas. And he writes a chapter on each one of them. Okay. Now, one of the other things that's interesting about Calvin is that Calvin was more concerned with stating positively, okay, what he believed to be true biblical Christianity rather than refuting the errors of the Catholic Church. Now, Luther is the opposite, okay? Luther and Huss are more, here's what's wrong with the church. Calvin sort of is like, well, we've already established what's wrong with the church. I'm going to write my book from the standpoint of, here's what we believe, okay? More of a positive spin on what he thought the faith was than pointing out all of the errors within the Catholic Church like Luther did. So that is definitely something to keep note of. Even Roman Catholic historian Camps Schulte, commented, without doubt, the most outstanding and most influential production in the sphere of dogmatics, that means doctrine and dogma, which the Reformation literature of the 16th century presents. In spite of this glowing report, Calvin's work was burned at Notre Dame in 1544. Okay, so the Catholics acknowledge, hey, yeah, this is a pretty good book for what it is, but we're still going to burn it. Okay, so they burned Calvin's Institutes the same as they burned Luther's books, the same as they burned Huss and Wycliffe and all the other believers down through history that were, you know, just foolish enough to stand up against the Catholic Church. Okay, but so that's, they acknowledge them for what they are, but they don't hesitate to destroy them either. Lawrence M. Vance, author of The Other Side of Calvinism, offers the following assessment of Calvin's Institutes. If you want to read accurate information about the Trinity and the deity of Christ, or find out what Reformation doctrine is, read it. If you want to ascertain the truth about baptism, the church, dispensations, the millennium, or the second coming of Christ, don't hold your breath while you look for them. Okay? He is thoroughly postmillennial. Okay? does not believe in the millennial reign of Christ, teaches infant baptism for salvation, Calvin does, same as the Catholic Church did, same as Luther also incorporated that in his system. Nothing in there about dispensations. He advocates for the allegorical reading, you know, of prophecy and stuff like that. So what you can get, areas where you could read Calvin and sort of get something out of it, would be his discussion on the Trinity, the deity of Christ, and to discover what the Reformers, what the Reformed tradition actually believes. Because they are all drawing from Calvin. Okay? Whether it's John Knox, we'll talk about in a little while, or whether it's the guys in the Netherlands, or in Germany, or wherever they were all drawing from Calvin. Okay? Alright, any questions about that before we go on to point three? Yeah?
What language did he write that in?
I think he wrote it in Latin, but it was quickly translated into French and then other languages. But I think he did write it in Latin. Don't quote me on that. I'll have to check. I think so, though. Any other questions about point number two? Yeah.
So he was quickly accepted as the leader of the Reformation at that time.
Well, we're going to get to that in the next point. He is going to... If you look at the Reformation in sort of two phases, the first... You can look at Erasmus as sort of the forerunner of the thing. Well, you can even go back further than that if you want to. Because Wycliffe is, I told you before, is called what? Wycliffe is referred to as the morning star of the Reformation. Okay? Contemporary with Wycliffe was Huss. Okay? Then you'd have Erasmus. Then Luther. And we learned last Sunday that contemporary with Luther was Zwingli. Okay? So, if you view Wycliffe as the morning star of the Reformation and Huss as alive and contemporary with shortly after the life of Wycliffe, and then Erasmus coming in there, and then Luther and Zwingli, Calvin would be sort of, Calvin's not born until, 1508? 1509. So he's a whole generation behind Luther in terms of age and so forth. So Calvin is sort of viewed as the leader of a second phase of the Reformation. Okay? Now, that's all also kind of going to depend on where you think the thing started. Most people think it officially starts with Luther, the posting of the theses on the door of the church. Okay? Which, I don't have any... That's what I said in class, so I don't have any reason to go against that. You've got Zwingli running contemporary with him. Bullinger's going to follow Zwingli. And then a little while later, Calvin is going to take over and he's going to run Geneva. Okay? So I would say, to answer your question, that Calvin is sort of the undisputed leader of the second phase of this Reformation. Luther is generally looked to as the first. Erasmus laid the egg that Luther hatched. Wycliffe kind of, gets the thing going, but he's off in England, and some of the ideas matriculate the year through Huss's followers and so forth. But Calvin is sort of viewed as the undisputed leader of this sort of second phase, if you will, of the Reformation. I have church history books at home that actually have early Reformation, later Reformation, and they start the later Reformation with Calvin. So, I don't know if this answers your question. Ultimately, that's just historian opinion. There's probably some good reasons to view it that way, but ultimately that's just one way of looking at it. Okay? Yeah.
So he didn't, Calvin, unless I read something, he didn't really think that much differently of the different practices of Catholicism except for the Trinity and stuff?
He's going to have a lot of differing beliefs, but they're not going to let everything go. Okay? They're going to hold on to some of that stuff. And next Sunday's lesson, we'll talk specifically about what did Calvin believe. Where was Calvin opposite of the Catholic Church? Where was he in line or in agreement or whatever with the Catholic Church. Yeah.
As a child, was he raised Catholic?
It's unclear. I think quasi-Catholic. I don't think his family was staunch by any stretch of the imagination. But he was familiar with the teaching of the church to some degree. Yeah.
Did he encounter this stuff when he was at the university?
He encounters Protestantism, yeah, when he's traveling between universities, and he meets a group of people in France who are reading the works of Luther and Erasmus. Yeah.
Didn't you say you were familiar with the humanistic movement at the time, and didn't you say that was more on a conservative bent back then, or a different...
Humanism then did not mean what humanism means now.
Right.
Yeah, humanism then meant you studied the classics. The classics meaning ancient Greek and Roman literature. So when he writes his first book, a commentary on Seneca, that's why. Because he's a humanist. So there's another trend with the Reformation. Almost all these guys in some way, shape, or form can be tied back through to who? Erasmus. Okay? And what Erasmus had to say, and so forth. So that's, I told you before, he's a key figure in all this. But he's also sort of there's more controversy surrounding Erasmus than there is a lot of the other guys whose names are on the board because of what he represents in the chain of the history. Yeah.
Was the French edition of the Textus Receptus out by this time?
By which time?
When Calvin was alive, yeah.
I think... Well, I gave you the date on that last Sunday, didn't I? The French edition? I think I did. I don't remember it off the top of my head. Does anybody have their notes from last week?
No, the German Bible wasn't complete until 1530.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been then.
No, I don't think so.
1522 is when the German New Testament was published. Okay.
So Calvin is sort of viewed as the leader of sort of the second wave. Okay? All right. Calvin rules Geneva. In 1536, on the heels of publishing his Institutes, Calvin decided to settle down to a private life in the city of Strasbourg. After embarking on his journey to Strasbourg, Calvin found the main road impassable due to an outbreak of war between Francis I of France and Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. By the way, that same emperor who's giving Luther trouble. Okay? You remember in a previous lesson we talked about how Luther got away with some stuff for a while because the emperor was distracted? Well, here's what he's distracted with, this war with France. Okay? So Calvin wants to go to Strasbourg. He's walking down the road and he finds his way blocked because of a battle that's occurring between these two armies. And if you go back to the notes, as a result, Calvin was forced to make an extended detour, which brought him through the newly independent city of Geneva. So he never intended to go to Geneva. Okay? He's forced to go to Geneva because the way that he wants to go is blocked, and he has to take an extended detour around this battle and around this whole thing between these two kings, and he ends up passing through Geneva as a result of having to take this detour. Having recently gained independence from the neighboring territory of Savoy, Geneva was in a state of confusion. Under the leadership of Gamaliel Farel and Pierre Viret, the local bishop had been evicted and a fledgling reform movement was in its infancy. So Calvin shows up, they just kicked the bishop out of town. They've just gotten Geneva has secured its independence as a city-state, and Calvin on this detour shows up almost shortly after all these things happen in the city of Geneva. Okay, Calvin intended to stay in Geneva for one night. However, upon learning of Calvin's presence in the city, Farel, a follower of Zwingli, begged Calvin to stay and help organize the reform movement in Geneva. So he doesn't even want to stay there. This guy's basically going to put the pressure on him to get him to stay. Now, this is somewhat of an interesting story. And now here we are with slides messed up again. I cannot get the reason for that. But anyway, inclined to continue on his way to Strasbourg, Calvin initially declined Farrell's promptings. A reply to which Farrell said, "You are only following your own wishes. If you do not help us in this work of the Lord will punish you for seeking your own interests rather than His." Woo! Talk about laying the guilt on. Okay? And what do you already know about Calvin's belief in the sovereignty of God? Okay? So is Calvin, you know, quaking in his boots a little bit under what this guy says to him here? Okay? So Calvin was terror-stricken. And the last thing he wanted was to offend Almighty God, so he consented to stay and immediately took up the reforming cause in Geneva. Alright? So this was never planned or never intended. It was obviously preordained and preplanned or sovereignly by God. You know, I'm being facetious, okay? Alright? But apart from this, a 3-year period in which he was temporarily expelled, Calvin stayed in Geneva for the duration of his life. 2 years later, after a religious and political quarrels, the Geneva City Council forced Calvin to leave the city. Calvin found refuge in Strasbourg, his original destination, and there Calvin cared for French Protestants, Huguenots, who, like Calvin, had fled because of persecution. Finally, he found the life of study that he has always wanted, and in 1539, Geneva needed someone to debate a Roman Catholic thinker, and the city council swallowed its pride and asked Calvin to return. Okay? So Calvin, he goes to Geneva, he's organizing this thing. There's a big debate between him and the city council about how the political and religious life of the city-state should be structured. They expel him, they kick him out, and he goes to Strasbourg. Okay? While he's in Strasbourg, he gets married. All of his kids, from what I read, died in early childhood. I don't think Calvin had any surviving offspring that lived. From all accounts, he was happily married to his wife, but all their children died, from what I could gather in the research. So,
did you see that as a sign that God was unhappy with him?
I couldn't say. I didn't come across anything that said that's how he interpreted it. Calvin and Farrell were banished from Geneva. It's just more detail here. In April 1538, for refusing compliance with what they regarded as improper interference of the civil authorities in the church's sphere. The two men had labored to make Geneva a model Protestant community, organized in such a fashion that the church and the state work together in harmony. So here we go again. Church, state, what? Union. Same as what happened with Lutheranism in Germany, same as what the church has been doing for, Catholic Church was doing for 1500 years, give or take, obviously. But here it is again. Church, state, union, and Calvin is advocating for it. While in Strasbourg, Calvin continued to enlarge and revise his institutes. Moreover, it was during this time that Calvin married, worked on his skills as a preacher, and attended various conferences with other reformers where he met and befriended Melanchthon, Luther's right-hand man. Now, you've got to remember that Melanchthon is younger than Luther. All right, he's probably more Calvin's, a little bit older than Calvin. But roughly, Melanchthon and Calvin are closer in age than Luther and Calvin were. Luther was at least 20 years older probably than Calvin, a whole generation earlier. Now, meanwhile, a shift in the political situation in Geneva brought into power the party friendly to Calvin. Its leaders besought him to return, and pressed by Farrell, and from a deep sense of duty, he reluctantly complied. From his arrival in September 1541 until his death, nearly a quarter of a century later, in May 27, 1564, he was the dominant figure in the city. Okay, so he goes back, and he's going to order this as sort of a Protestant reformed utopia. And he's going to mold it after his own view of how that should happen. In 1539, Calvin opened a new academy. Despite being so lacking in funds that he was forced to go from house to house in person to raise the money, the academy taught Protestant theology as well as providing a rigorous training in science and humanism, making it a Protestant answer to the schools of the Jesuits that were popping up across Europe. Okay? The academy was enormously popular, accepting 900 students in its opening year, an increase in class sizes and subsequent uptakes. Calvin recognized that this was an excellent way of spreading Protestant ideals. And spread they did, as alumni from the academy returned home and preached what they had learned there. What are they going to be preaching? They're going to be preaching Calvinistic doctrine. Okay? So how does, for example, the Netherlands become predominantly Calvinistic? Through the school, through the graduates of the school that Calvin is putting out. Okay? So they go back to their homelands, they preach what they learned, and they establish churches molded after or modeled upon the way Calvin taught the church should be. So when the Dutch decide to come to America, for example, what do they bring with them? They bring their Calvinism with them. And then when they set up their communities here in the New World, they set them up according to what they, the only thing they know, and their predominating philosophy is going to be the Calvinistic interpretation of Scripture and so forth. And so the Calvin's influence is going to cross the waters here. Okay? It's going to touch America. It's going to touch all over because of the influence of Calvin's school. All right?
So that's the main point, that Calvin created the school where Luther didn't.
One of the main differences. Yep.
And the Puritans and everything are Calvinistically based too, aren't
they? Oh yeah, the Puritans, you know, the Puritans that come over, you know, and settle Massachusetts and the northern colonies here in the United States, they're all Calvinist. They're Calvinist to the core. I've got books at school where quoting from the journals of some of these guys as they watch the Native Americans die of smallpox by the thousands. These guys are sitting writing in their journals about how clearly this is a sign of the providence of God that He has chosen to give us this land. I'm not kidding. Okay? This thing, their thinking on this extends to that the Native Americans being stricken, God striking them with these diseases so that they can have the land. So, it's pretty extreme.
Even today, isn't the Calvinistic view that we're going to shake up and then the Lord can come back? It's almost like kingdom now, I think.
All that stuff has its roots in this theology.
Right. It's strong.
Yeah.
Even the United States today, the Calvinistic view is that we feed on a few Catholics and Calvinists.
You cannot escape the impact of Calvin's theology. The whole idea of the Protestant work ethic.
Right.
And how that shaped America. I mean, there's just a number of ways that you could really discuss this, you know, angles that you could take in discussing this. But I'll just tell you my personal opinion now. You can take it for what it's worth. But when these Puritans come over to establish freedom of religion, they're establishing freedom to worship. Could you have lived in Massachusetts in 1700s and not have been a Puritan? No way. They would have kicked you out and told you to go to some other colony. So what did they mean by freedom of religion? They meant the freedom for them to enforce their own religious ideas in order of their own religious community. You know, and if you look at the founding of the colonies, that's why almost, not all in every case, but in almost every case, each colony had was predominantly ruled or settled by people of a particular denomination. So you end up with Maryland, for example, which is the Catholic colony. All the Catholics moved to Maryland. The Puritans moved to Massachusetts, New England Bay. The Baptists moved to Georgia and areas in North and South Carolina. And, you know, anywhere in between, the Quakers and those guys, they're going to settle down in Pennsylvania. And so if you look at who's settling where in the New World, they're settling according to denominational traditions in a lot of cases. Yeah.
I think early Pennsylvania was the only colony that had freedom of religion, and that's why a lot of groups were there.
Yeah, there's a lot of different groups, but at first, almost all of them had a particular bent or slant that they were, you know. Yeah, Doug?
Is that what happened in South Africa also? The Dutch in South Africa?
Well, I mean, yeah, the Dutch, when the Dutch settled South Africa, they bring all that Calvinist tradition with them down there. Sure.
I mean, there's a lot of commotion happening down there.
Well, there's a lot of other factors going on there too, but you know, certainly they, anywhere they go, they bring it with them. So that's how you end up with Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Why? Because the settlers that first came to this area were almost all exclusively Dutch Reformed. And they had been taught by the graduates of Calvin School. Okay?
And they're durable and hardworking and everything.
Yeah, I mean, they've got that ethic burned into their mind too, which isn't a bad thing, okay? That aspect of it. All right, where am I? Okay. Calvin, as well as Luther and Zwingli, never escaped the idea that the church and the government ought to be linked with one another. Under Calvin's direction, the government of Geneva was transformed into something like a Protestant theocracy. It became known as the Protestant Rome. The French philosopher Voltaire went so far as to call Calvin the Protestant Pope. Okay? Under Calvin's leadership, a close cooperation between church and state was carried through. A form of church organization was set up through the ordinances, a catechism was prepared, and a liturgy was introduced based on that which he had developed at Strasbourg. He had the discipline of community morals and the subterry legislation enforced, which in theory had long been advocated by the Roman Catholic Church. That's a fascinating point, because what Lorette's saying there is that Calvin, in a sense, is able to do something that even the Catholics were never able to do that they wish they could have done. And the way he's going to govern and rule Geneva. Okay? Although persecuted by Catholics himself, Calvin did not hesitate to set up a church state at Geneva like his predecessor Zwingli did at Zurich. Calvin was a firm believer in a united church state. From 1541 to 1546, 58 people were executed, and 76 were exiled from Geneva. Calvin was consulted in all important matters of state, and his advice were usually followed. Press censorship continued in Geneva until the 18th century. Attendance at public worship was commanded, and watchmen were directed to see that people went to church. Three men who laughed during a sermon were imprisoned for 3 days, and death sentences were routinely imposed. A girl was beheaded for striking her parents, and some were burned for witchcraft. Okay? Now, this is the kind of stuff that the Calvinists don't like you talking about. Okay? The city council had absolute power in matters religious as well as civil, and it became the instrument of Calvin's will. The citizens were required to sign a confession of faith or leave the city. The strict rules were enforced regulating the morals and habits of the people. The churches that had begun to grow up in obedience to the New Testament teaching also disappeared in general organization, for papal rule was replaced by that of the reformer, and liberty of conscience was still withheld. So you can't live in Geneva and not be a Calvinist. You have to sign a confession of faith to even have permission to live in the city, and anybody that didn't or caused trouble was either exiled or killed. The clearest example of the power of Calvin's Geneva can be seen in the execution of Michael Servetus. Servetus was a highly educated doctor of medicine who spoke 6 languages. he was forced to live undercover because of his heretical doctrinal views. Now, what are these doctrinal views that he is so heretical? Premillennial. Okay? Rejected Calvin's doctrine of predestination. Anti-Catholic, calls the Pope a dragon and the Antichrist, the dragon of Revelation, in his writings, and said that the Mass was satanic. Okay, that's what this guy said. By the way, there's also research I read this week that says that this doctor discovered how blood flows through the body before, who was it that discovered that? Supposedly Bacon? Or Kepler? No, it wasn't Kepler. I think it was Bacon. I don't know if that's true or not, but I just throw that out there to you. So, he's heretical. Why? He's premillennial. He rejected Calvin's doctrine of predestination. He says that the Pope is anti-Catholic and the Mass was satanic. Okay? Now, I look at those and I say, he's not a heretic. But who does? So, all the reformers essentially agreed on these points. Okay? If you go, except for which one? Do all the reformers generally agree about the Pope being the dragon of Revelation? Yeah. Do they all generally believe the Mass is satanic? Well, where's he going to run into trouble then? Premillennialism and what?
Predestination.
All the reformers essentially agree on these points. So what did Servetius... So what got Servetius in trouble with the authorities in Geneva? First, he rejected infant baptism as a demonic invention of the papacy and was not shy to inform Calvin of his views in two letters addressed to him. Second, he unfortunately was not orthodox in his views on the Trinity. I do think that that is true, that he was not Trinitarian. In 1553 at Vienna, Servetus was imprisoned by the Catholics. Okay? Faking a trip to the outhouse, Servetus escaped and foolishly fled to Geneva. He could have went anywhere he wanted, but he goes to Geneva instead. I don't know why he did that. Theodore Beza, Calvin's protege, reports that Calvin himself reported Servetus' presence to the local magistrate who arrested him. Okay? In a trial lasting more than 2 months, Calvin himself drew up a document of 39 accusations against Servetius. 5 days into the trial, Calvin wrote to Farrell, "I hope the sentence of death will at last be passed upon him." Despite reform claims to the contrary, Calvin played a role in the matter throughout the arrest, trial, and execution of Servetius. That's him, by the way, okay, the doctor. On October 27, 1553, Servetius was burned at the stake in Geneva. Calvin was not alone in his views of killing heretics. Bullinger and Melanchthon approved of the execution. Melanchthon wrote to Calvin, "The church owes and always will owe a debt of gratitude to you for having put the heretic to death." Okay, so now the Reformation is eating its own. That's not E.W. Bullinger. That's a different Bullinger. Heinrich or something like that, I think. Is that Heinrich? That's not...
Yeah, Bullinger is related to him.
Yeah.
Really? Okay. I had a couple thoughts. The language is so black and white. Like, this guy, speaks six languages. I mean, must have been brilliant. And he rejected infant baptism as a demonic invention, you know? So would we say that? It's a demonic invention? Isn't that language that is just to inflame people when you use that? He was looking for a fight, it seems.
Possibly.
Doctrine of the devil.
Doctrine of
the devil? Paul says that, right?
I don't think we say that, would you?
Well, to the extent that Paul... If I were standing in the pulpit, I would not say... I probably would not say this is demonic outside of saying what Paul says. Is that a politically correct answer for you? I would say they're wrong. I would say this is not right, or heresy, I mean, or whatever term you want to use for it. But you'll see next Sunday that, look, let's go back even further than this. You cannot find any Roman Catholic doctrine that cannot be tied back to Augustine. But you know what else Augustine taught? Infant baptism and predestination. Okay? So, remember we talked earlier in this class about Augustine and Pelagius and their big argument over free will or predestination. Remember that? Okay, that was a long time ago now. So I know that's the outer recesses of your mind at this point. But Calvin is going to be drawing his information from who? Augustine.
Oh, yeah.
So, all of these, that's why we talked so, spent 2 weeks on Augustine way back when, because what he's going to do is he's going to fundamentally pull out and emphasize a different set of Augustine's teachings than what the church did. Okay? Calvin is going to draw from Augustine the ideas about grace, which in my mind isn't really even grace, but grace and predestination he's going to get. The Catholics over here are going to focus on, I cannot talk and spell at the same time. The Catholics are going to focus on Augustine's doctrine of what? Church. But it all stems from, in one way, shape, or form, or manner, back to who? Augustine. Norm, you get your hand up.
Well, I was going to say, it all goes back to what you started the whole lesson with. Is it the Bible, or what men say, and then mm-hmm. men's doctrine? And the Catholic, it appears the Protestants are doing the same thing as the Catholics.
Exactly. So what originally was a good movement, based on some good points, is going to ultimately, what's it going to result in? Okay? Influence of Geneva. Under Calvin, Geneva became a haven for oppressed Protestants from many lands. In it, men were trained who went back to their native countries to further the Reformation. While they did not always slavishly reproduce what they had seen there, through them and his writings, Calvin became the most powerful single factor in shaping the distinctive features of the Reformed churches. Okay? You ever heard of a little thing called the Geneva Bible? Where was that written? That was translated into English by English exiles who fled to Geneva under the reign of Bloody Mary. So they translate the Bible into English from Geneva and then send it back. And when they do that, it is the marginal notations that are placed in the Geneva Bible then are Calvinistic in their outlook of things, because they are, the whole translation is done and put together by English followers of John Calvin who take refuge there and translate the Bible from Geneva. That's why it's called the Geneva Bible. Which is, by the way, one reason why King James hated the Geneva Bible. Okay, but we'll get into all that stuff later. There you go. See, you got a conference. You come to the conference, you learn all that stuff. There you go. From Geneva, Reformed Church movements took hold in Scotland, Germany, Netherlands, and France, with the activities of the Huguenots. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the Huguenots, just other than to mention them. The Huguenots, those are French sympathizing Catholics. They're French Calvinists, what they are. And if you've ever heard of the Edict of Nantes, the Edict of Nantes is going to be signed in France, limiting the number of cities where the Calvinists could worship. And then Cardinal Richelieu, when he comes to power, he's gonna really tick them off by putting forth an order that they can't build walls around their cities. Because at that time in history, having a walled city was still a big defense mechanism. But anyway, so they're basically, the Huguenots are French Calvinists, is what they are. All right. France is going to have its own set of wars back and forth between the Calvinists and the Catholics in France. Now, the biggest disciple of Calvin specifically from another country is John Knox. Okay? John Knox was perhaps the most prominent of the religious exiles to take refuge in Geneva. Knox was a restless activist who had tried earlier to point England in the direction of Calvinism. Like many others, he was forced to leave England overnight when in 1553 the country returned to the Catholic faith under Henry VIII's daughter, Mary I. The Queen's persecution of Protestant leaders earned her the title Bloody Mary. Okay? Now, Knox escaped to the continent where he developed the theory that Protestants had the right to resist by force if necessary. Any Roman Catholic ruler who tried to prevent their worship and mission. That was farther than Calvin was willing to go, but many of the nobles in Scotland found the idea attractive. When civil war broke out in Scotland in 1559, Knox rushed home. And by the summer of 1560, the Calvinists were in control of Edinburgh. Okay? Under John Knox, the Scots became Calvinists. In 1560, their parliament officially disestablished the Roman Church and ratified a confession of faith prepared by Knox. Here, the Reformed Church did away with bishops, holding this form of church government to be unscriptural. A system of elders or presbyters was instituted as more in keeping with the New Testament, and Scottish Calvinism is thus sometimes known as Presbyterianism. Okay? Vance reports that the Presbyterianism became the state church of England due to the influence of John Knox, who studied under Calvin. Now, I'm going to correct that. That should say Scotland.
Okay.
Not England. So the last point, when Calvin died in 1564, he left more than a reformed Geneva. Okay? All over Europe and soon in distant America, his followers would spread his teachings all over the world. Okay? Now, any questions about Calvin? Or anything we went over today or whatever. Next week we're going to look at more detail about what he believed. Yeah.
I think that the Roman Catholic Church had
They wouldn't have had the Catholic Church would not have had a conference in Geneva when Calvin was there or after. Okay. He influenced by his thinking on it.
Like predestination, I mean, that's a Calvinistic doctrine. So he must have taken it, believed it real hard, and just for all of his work. Right?
Well, again, he gets the idea from Augustine, and then he sets about explaining it. And Calvin never explained it in terms of Tulip. Okay? That comes later. Okay? We're going to talk next week. Have you ever heard of the Canon of Dort? It's going to come out of the Canons of Dort is where the Tulip acronym is going to have its origin. All the doctrines that are summarized by the Tulip are taught by Calvin in the Institutes. Okay? But they're not packaged in that nice, neat little form until later, because James Arminius is going to come along and offer 5 points of what are called the Remonstrance against Calvin. which is why the canons of Dort are going to be called to begin with to settle this issue. And that's why they have the Snoid or the Synod of Dort to start with. The canons of Dort are the end product or official statement of that meeting. But that council or that the canons of Dort are unique because they only deal with the 5 points of Calvinism. So you can really say and see where the tulip came from. It came from that. But all those ideas are in the Institutes. Yeah.
When everybody with more Baptistic backgrounds before coming to the Grace Movement, they all question this infant baptism of the Reformers. What we as 20th and 21st century Americans do not realize is how many of everybody's babies died up until our generation. It was an emotional thing for them.
I'm sure that's true. It was also a theological thing. Because if you go, I forget which church father it was, but what they do is they say, well, Israel doesn't exist anymore, so there is no more circumcision, so therefore, baptism does what?
Takes the place
of circumcision. So if the Old Testament law said that they were supposed to be circumcised the eighth day, that's where you get the whole idea of baptizing what? An infant. Okay? So all that is coming from, a whole that's why we spent so much time in the beginning, because when they departed from Paul, when Paul was still alive, this is what you end up with. Okay? Now, one of the interesting questions that you could talk about, and I got to shut up here, is the Reformation over? Now, that's an interesting question. Okay? So, you and I, as 21st century mid-acts, grace dispensationalists, we definitely can trace ourselves back through some of this stuff, but we can't settle here on any one doctrine or any one teaching or one tradition and say that's it. You follow what I'm saying? So that's why I think that we need to continue this class after after summer vacation. Because that'll be the focus of the second half. We'll be taking it from the Reformation till now. How do we get to where we are now? Okay? Because, that's where guys like John Nelson Darby and the Plymouth Brethren and people who are going to be, making distinctions between Israel and the church, between the rapture and the second coming. They're going to come along and they're going to make these distinctions and they're going to end up being critical to how we get to where we are now. The truth is uncovered. And uncovered every successive generation. And even in this, there are always churches, there are always people who would say, I'm not Lutheran, I'm not Reformed, okay, I'm not a follower of Calvin, but I'm also not what? Catholic. Free churches, not part of any of these denominational structures. But we got to quit, okay? Thanks for your attention.